The idea of renormalization group limit cycles is probably unfamiliar to many people in the audience, although people who've been in the game for 30 years almost certainly are aware of it. What I want to do in this talk is explain a simple observation or conjecture made recently by Hans Hammer and me, and that is QCD has an infrared renormalization group limit cycle. More specifically, physical QCD is fortuitously close to the critical renormalization group trajectory for infrared limit cycle in the few nucleon sector. And the conjecture is that it can actually be tuned to the critical trajectory by adjusting the up and down quark masses. And this has implications for trying to extract nuclear physics from lattice gauge theory. It has implications for trying to describe low energy nuclear physics using effective field theories. And QCD or few nuclear system doesn't interest you much, at least I hope the idea of this renormalization group limit cycle you'll find at least intriguing. And maybe there are other examples out there waiting to be discovered. So, well, this claim is phrased in renormalization group language, and it might sound a little obscure. So let me tell you a simple consequence of this that might make it more concrete. In QCD, the observable that's most sensitive to the light quark masses is the pion mass with a physical mass of 138 MeV, and the few nucleon states are well known. There's a single proton-neutron bound state called the deuteron with a binding energy of 2.4 MeV. The spin singlet analog of that is not bound. There, in the three nucleon sector, there's a single proton-neutron-neutron bound state, the triton, and it has no excited states. But the claim is that if you tune the up and down quark masses a little farther away from the chiral symmetric point, namely to somewhere in the neighborhood of 180 MeV, the few nucleon spectrum will look very different. The binding energy of the deuteron will be tuned to zero. The spin singlet analog will also be on the verge of being bound. But in the three nucleon sector, things get very interesting. The triton will not change much. Yes, as the bound state is shallower and shallower, the size of the bound state gets larger and larger. Well, you don't need even pion exchange. If you look at just the problem of particles and potentials, okay. If you have a very shallow bound state,
right. But the statement is based on that, on just potential models.
The statement that you can come pretty close to tuning to this point comes from using effective field theories to do a chiral extrapolation of the.
So it's the pion we're tuning.
Yes. Yes.
But why? What I don't understand, as I certainly understand how it might be the smaller than eventually zero, why does that happen at the same point when it's been?
Well, you need to tune to get that point, and you have two tuning parameters. Yeah. Well, you have the up and down quark masses provide you with two tuning parameters. And
so you're changing the proton. Okay, but in nuclear physics, you just have proton, neutron, and pion potential.
And isospin breaking effects that you could conceivably tune. But you have two tuning parameters, and I need to tune. The chiral extrapolations that have been done thus far are just extrapolation in mu plus md with mu minus md fixed by varying the pion mass.
When you do the nuclear physics calculation, mm-hmm. you don't see up and down quark masses.
No.
You see pion ranges, mm-hmm. potentials, proton neutron masses. What is it that.
Well, you have isospin breaking effects that split proton and neutron along with electromagnetic effects,
so
and you could conceive.
Changing the proton-neutron masses?
If you were if you were to tune that other combination of up and down quark mass, you'd be changing the masses by a small amount. But you would be changing the size of isospin violation. Well, one of these is an isospin singlet, and the other is an isospin triplet. So when you vary up and down both, you can vary isospin singlet and isospin triplet effects independently.
So does the triplet get split then into three because it's sort of breaking? Does
that mean? Yeah, it would, just like, I mean,
so
just like it, I mean, it is in the real world.
Yeah, I forget. I don't know the quantum numbers of the deuteron. I don't tell the grad students this, but I
could. Deuteron is.
Deuteron is a spin one isospin singlet. And, the spin singlet isospin one is not bound.
Not bound.
But it.
The bound state will be in the isospin zero or one channel.
They'll be in both. I mean, you want to take your two tuning parameters to tune both of these binding energies to zero.
The second one is the isospin one channel.
Yes.
So you really can.
No, I just yeah. Well, in terms of the effective. The isospin breaking effects are mostly in the couplings.
Not much. I mean, there. And so those extrapolations have not been done.
There's no obvious linear effect in the parameter. I think there's no obvious linear effect in M up minus M down.
Yes.
And the nuclear masses don't affect these binding energies.
Well, the binding energy is 1 over the mass times the scattering length squared, so the mass comes in, but not sensitively.
Anyway, you say it's not possible.
It's not inconceivable. You have two tuning parameters. You want to tune two things.
Right. And what values do you have to do?
Well,
mass, but there's nothing. The other parameter, I suppose, is mu over mv. Does that go to 15?
I don't know. But the tuning of m pi alone is good enough to get you close. And the hope is the small tuning of mu minus md will get you to this point.
So it hasn't actually been done.
It has not been done. The chiral extrapolation m pi has been done.
That's my answer to my question. The statement is based on the fact that you have two parameters.
So yes.
And you have two things to fit, so you think it could be done.
And one parameter has already brought you close. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, how what's the consequence? Well, the dramatic consequences are in the three nucleon sector. The triton will not change much, but there will be shallow excited state of the triton that's 50 times less bound. There'll be another one that's 500 times less bound, and there'll be more and more increasingly shallow excitations of the triton. And the ratio of adjacent binding energies will approach a universal number that's close to 515.03. So that's the signature of this infrared limit cycle.
Why? That's because you say the three budding bound states, which will be this partial bound state plus
material. Well. These will be roughly spherically symmetric, but increasingly large three-body bound states.
How do I know that?
I'll get to that. Okay, so this is what I want to convince you is at least plausible. And I'm going to start by telling you a couple stories that go way back 30 years ago, two independent theoretical developments. One has to do with the renormalization group and features Ken Wilson, and the other involves an idea called low-energy universality and features Vitaly Efimov. And after that, I will discuss quantum field theories that have renormalization group limit cycles. One is a theory that that describe identical bosons with large scattering length. And this is relevant to current experiments in atomic physics. Another one is the effective field theories that describe the low-energy few nucleon problem. And then I'll discuss the chiral extrapolation that suggests that there is actually a infrared limit cycle in QCD. So let me start with renormalization group. Ken Wilson developed the renormalization group to describe critical phenomena in condensed matter physics. And these are systems near a point where line of first order phase transitions ends. For example, the end point of the liquid gas phase transition in a gas, or the temperature at which discontinuity and magnetization of a ferromagnet disappears. Near these critical points, the correlators have power law behavior. The correlation functions fall off like powers of the separation. This means that there is no length, that is, as the separation increases, gets increasingly large, it means that there's no length scales at long distances. You have asymptotic scale invariants. It's also non-trivial behavior because these critical exponents do not have the simple values predicted by dimensional analysis. So you have non-trivial behavior near the critical point. And Wilson explained how this might arise from the renormalization group. Your starting point is a microscopic Hamiltonian that describes the system even at very short distances, and the longest behavior is a very complicated consequence of this microscopic Hamiltonian. Renormalization group transformations are designed to eliminate short distance degrees of freedom in such a way to keep long distance behavior invariant. This defines an effective Hamiltonian that you can express in terms of simply varied changing the coupling constants for operators in the Hamiltonian. This defines a renormalization group flow in the space of dimensionless coupling constants. These coupling constants will satisfy a simple RG equation that is determined by a beta function. Now, Wilson's observation is that the simple, non-trivial, long-distance behavior that you find in critical phenomena could be explained by simple renormalization group flow in the infrared limit. That is, as the ultraviolet momentum cutoff gets smaller and smaller. And the simplest possibility is just renormalization group flow to an infrared fixed point. There can be points in the space of coupling constants that do not change at all under renormalization. If you have such a point, there can be lines that as you evolve the coupling constant, asymptotically approach the fixed points. Those are called critical trajectories. And the tuning of a system to the critical point, tuning of macroscopic variables like pressure and temperature to a critical point, corresponds in the space of coupling constants to tuning the coupling constants to a point on the critical trajectory. And then as you go to longer and longer distances, the behavior will be dominated by this fixed point. But around this time, Wilson also suggested that renormalization group might also be relevant to the strong interactions. This is before QCD, so the strong interactions were still a great mystery. They were believed to involve quarks in some way. There were hints in data on deep inelastic scattering from slack that there was scaling behavior at high energies. And so there seemed to be simple, non-trivial behavior at high energies. And Wilson suggested that whatever was the correct description of the strong interactions was likely to be a quantum field theory, and it would be described by some set of dimensionless coupling constants that would be governed by the renormalization group. And if this is true, the simple high energy behavior could be explained by simple renormalization group flow in the ultraviolet limit, where the cutoff goes to infinity. And the simplest possibility is, again, a fixed point, a point which is invariant under renormalization group flow, and it might have critical trajectories that flow there as you increase the cutoff. The next simplest possibility, since these renormalization group equations are just coupled equations for the coupling constants, you could have a limit cycle. You could have closed loops in the space of coupling constants that where the flow would just go round and around the loop, and you might have critical trajectories that asymptotically flow towards this closed loop. Well, if you do have such a thing, it's natural to parameterize the points around the limit cycle by an angle that goes from 0 to 2 pi, and so your coupling constants would be periodic functions of that angle. The fact, statement that the limit cycle is closed under renormalization is just saying that the flow is in the direction provided by the gradient with respect to the angle theta. And if you just combine those equations, you can conclude that the coupling constant should be a periodic function of the logarithm of the cutoff. And so if there is a limit cycle in ultraviolet limit cycle in QCD, that would be the consequence. The coupling constant would be a periodic function of the log of the cutoff. And what can you conclude from that? Well, I'm sorry?
Which is why this is so counterintuitive. If, first, certainly, you're talking about the Wilsonian formulation, so which is irreversible fitting out of the green theorem, and how the hell could that be periodic?
I'll show you explicit examples, and then maybe it's easier to figure out how it
so
can be.
Somebody has been. You know, we originally, I was looking at this possibility of it. Beta function, which is a reversible normalization of the log, except marginal operator. But you know, the general Wilsonian approach, you take the Polchinski equation, you lose information.
Well, but if you have infinite.
That's never been.
It's
never been so completely clear. I mean, yes, you throw stuff away, but you also you have as many at all times. You kind of have as many degrees of freedom that you're looking at because
you
throw away,
but
you scale, and you throw.
There are
two dimensions.
Ways
of
deep
theorems.
And I think there are even people who claim that in Ireland. But just intuitively, it's a one-way thinning procedure.
But if you have infinitely many degrees of freedom.
You can't go back.
And so how can you go around the circle?
Well, you're not getting back. You're not getting the same use through
that.
That
cycle is really
periodic. All right. But as you scale by 500, you've thrown away all these. I mean, it doesn't say that the thinning doesn't prevent the physics from being periodic.
Only a circle and coupling constants.
Yeah.
So. No, this is flow.
Flow consists of, if you want. Throwing away, dividing the theory on a larger scale, I'm throwing away a higher momentum degrees of freedom. As you throw away more and more, you get back to the same point. Yeah, I don't see how that's.
Or to a point that
in,
looks
in
the same.
In three dimensions where it's absolutely clear how to count, and you have gradient flow, you know, the beta functions are the derivative of the C function, which counts in degrees of freedom, and you have gradient flow, the C function decreases. Consistent with your intuitive feel about what the normalization group is achieving, which is why this is rather hard to imagine happening. Although it's, you know, as Joe says, there are infinity divided by 2 is still infinity.
Yes, exactly.
And 0 over 0 could be anything.
But it's hard to see how an irreversible flow it seems to have something which is decreasing monotonically.
I think if you're willing to sort of consider complex coupling constants, it's not hard. Then a normalized stable fixed part becomes a limit cycle. So I mean, it's just in the there. I guess this is a physical system.
Mathematically speaking, you can certainly invent things whether they could come from.
Alerts, right. I mean, in condensed matter systems, you get things that are not unitary field theories because it's not time that you're. It's all spatial. Anyway, well, you have.
I'll give you explicit examples, and then you can puzzle how they succeed in evading your intuition. Well, suppose this is the case. How would you know this? How would you recognize a renormalization group limit cycle if you saw one? Well, Ken Wilson gave a simple way of seeing if there was a renormalization group limit cycle in QCD. And that is simply to look at the ratio R of E plus C minus annihilation. I'm sorry. Yes. If there was a limit cycle in strong interactions, ultraviolet limit cycle, how would you know it? And the answer is that you can look at the ratio R of E plus C minus annihilation. And if it, this is roughly the range of data that was available in 1970. And if you go to higher energies and you find that this approaches a constant, you can conclude, you can infer that the renormalization is governed by a fixed point. If you find that it oscillates on a logarithmic scale, then your conclusion will be that it is governed by a limit cycle. So let's just see. I'm sorry? If I want to look for an ultraviolet limit cycle, I would go to higher energies. It's easy to see why this should be the case. This ratio R is a dimensionless observable. Okay.
All the odd fixed points happen to be under control. I mean, QCD, we know it's really under control. But
okay. Well, if there was, I mean, if there was such a thing, this ratio R is dimensionless. It also has no anomalous dimensions, and because it can be expressed as in terms of matrix element of a conserved current. And therefore, well, it's a function of dimensionless variables. The variables available for this completely inclusive quantity are the energy, which I can make dimensionless by dividing by the coupling constant, and whatever dimensionless coupling constants are describing the strong interactions. Renormalization group flow is defined to make the physical quantities like R invariant. So this should be independent of lambda. And so I can simply set lambda equal to root S in this equation. And I get the formula at the bottom here. And if you stare at that, you'll realize that what it tells you is that if these coupling constants are periodic functions of the ratio, periodic functions of the logarithm at the cutoff, then the ratio R must be a periodic function of the logarithm of root S. And that's how you would conclude that you should see periodic oscillations on a logarithmic scale. Well, we have the benefit of 30 years of hindsight. So what did they see? Well, unfortunately, this is what they saw. Life got more complicated. At 3 GeV, the charmonium resonance has made an appearance, and that marked the opening up of the charm threshold. And at 10 GeV, the bottomonium resonance appeared, marking the opening up of the bottom threshold, and then the Z resonance. And anyway, it was more complicated. But we also learned in the meantime that strong interactions are described by QCD, and QCD is governed by an ultraviolet fixed point and not a limit cycle. It's a very simple fixed point for which the value is zero, and therefore this ratio is a very simple interpretation. It's just the 3 times the sum of the charge squared. And anyway, the bottom line is that ultraviolet limit cycles are irrelevant in QCD. And the question is, can limit cycles play a role in any other area of physics? Okay, so that's the first story I was going to tell. The second story has to do with work by Vitaly Efimov that seems totally orthogonal. But let me tell you about it. This was also work that goes back to 1970, but since I'm from Ohio State, I have to start the story even earlier. In 1935, we worked by a guy named Thomas, who was a professor at Ohio State at that time. This is the Thomas of the Thomas Fermi model of the odd atom and Thomas precession, and so his name is quite familiar. But he was motivated by the nuclear physics problem that the deuteron is a very shallow bound state of a proton and neutron. And so he considered the problem of particles interacting with a two-body potential with one bound state. And he looked at it in a particular limit. And that is a limit where you make the potential shallower and shallower and deeper in such a way that this bound state remains fixed. He looked at the three-body spectrum and by simple variational arguments was able to show that the deepest three-body bound state would diverge to minus infinity. That is, in this limit, the spectrum is unbounded from below. So it's a kind of a counterintuitive thing. if you can have a potential that's only strong enough to give you a very shallow two-body bound state, and somehow it's able to give you an extremely deeply bound three-body bound state. So it's amusing and counterintuitive. But of course, the details of this, I mean, this deep binding energy depends upon the details of the potential and how you take the limit, and so there's nothing universal there. But what Efimov realized 30 years later, 35 years.
Is it a simple way of understanding?
Well, it's just a simple, just write down the right variational wave function and it's automatic. But the simple way to understand it is, I mean, that's one way to understand it, but
that's a good one. So if I then look at that simple variational wave function, what does it look like? What is it doing?
Well, what you're getting is a very large separation between the scattering length and the range of the potential. And in that region, the three-body problem becomes scale invariant. And
somehow bound state that consists of lots of iterated two-body-ish.
No, it's a intrinsically three-body thing that's roughly, these deep ones are roughly spherically symmetric. Wave functions look like Bessel functions that have nodes that are spaced geometrically. But this deep bound state is very, very large. So it's, the deep bound state is small, comparable to the range of this potential. I mean, well, let me go to the next step. What you find is that between the scale of the scattering length and the range of the potential, the problem becomes scale invariant, and so there's a sequence of three-body bound states that get increasingly deep, and this is the endpoint of that sequence. In the right coordinate, in the appropriate coordinate.
What?
Yeah. Yes, it's one over r squared potential in the appropriate coordinate. In the mean square separation of the three particles. What Efimov realized 35 years later is that although this thing depends upon the details of the potential, what's going on in between here is universal and does not depend on the details. He considered basically the same problem, a two-body bound state a two-body potential with one bound state. But he considered the resonant limit, where I take this potential and keep the range fixed, but adjust the depth of the potential in such a way to drive this bound state closer and closer to the threshold. And again, looked at the spectrum of three-body bound states. And what he found is that there's a sequence of these states. They range from very deeply bound states whose energy is set by the scale provided by the range, and very shallow bound states whose energy scale is set by the scattering length. And the number increases logarithmically with the scattering length. This is, the spacing between these approaches a number that's 515.03, which is the solution to a simple transcendental equation. So something is solvable exactly, but there's things that are not. Okay. I'm sorry?
It is not exactly.
No, it is not. But I mean, there are some things that, for which you can say things analytic, but
interacting with delta function potential.
Yes.
This is
a three-body problem. It's that problem, but the three-body in the three-body sector.
Yeah.
The two-body problem.
N-body problem is solvable if they interact by delta function, but this is not delta function. This is a rectangle.
Well,
they're both Gauss.
This is universal. So it is, whether it's a delta function or anything else, it's the same. You will see this exactly the same behavior with the delta function potential.
Delta function is solvable by Bernstein bus.
How many dimensions are you in?
One dimension.
Okay. This is real world. Three dimensions. Well, this, the best thing to do is just solve the three-body problem and solve the Schrodinger equation, this is from solving the problem, you can get this information out. And it can't be done analytically, but it can be done numerically with high accuracy.
Does that have something to do with the fact that when you set up the three-body problem, there are these sequence of two-body collisions that get caused big effect in forward direction?
Yeah, you have to worry, but you have three particles and then two can collide and they can interact for a long time, and then one collides with the other one and they interact. And
I'm just wondering whether that's the origin of the effect. So you always had a bound state, so you always have, you have a large scattering line.
Yes.
So does this arise from that sequence of multiple?
Yes.
Is that what it comes from, the physics of
it? Yes. Mm-hmm. That multiple rescattering has logarithmic singularities at short distances, and it's those singularities that are responsible for this effect. Forward. I mean, it's S-wave scattering, so it's not. It's.
Yeah, it's S-wave scattering.
It's not. It's. Yeah.
It's almost. It's almost on check. Now, you can have. It's like real variable. Real good variable. You can have a rescattering diagram where it looks like something virtual. Two particles scatter. This one.
Yes.
It's this one. Right?
Oops.
And normally this is off shelf.
Right.
But this can be for succession, a real scattering.
Yeah, so it's a succession of two body scatterings.
And so that can.
And you're
singular behavior because it's essentially.
And you're tuning the scattering length to be large, so these are all strong interactions.
Right.
So you have the sequence of strong interactions that when you iterate to all orders generate this universal behavior. Just for those who aren't so familiar with the scattering length, this is just a reminder of what it is. Well, scattering length you can think of as the strength of the scattered wave compared to the incoming incoming plane wave. But if you're a field theorist, the best way to think of it is simply the strength of the two-body contact interaction. And so when you tune the scattering length to be large, you're just tuning the strength of this contact interaction to be increasingly large. Okay, Efimov found that there was a sequence of bound states and ratios of successive bound states approached some universal number, 515.03. This turned out to be just the tip of the iceberg of much more general phenomena of universality, which he developed in several papers in the 70s. This is something that you see when the scattering length is large and you look at low energies. So when the scattering length is large compared to the range of the potential, and you look at energy small compared to the scale set by the potential, then you will find universal behavior. That is, the behavior at long distances is insensitive to the details at short distances. You also find scaling behavior. Your scattering length is made large, and few body observers will scale as powers of the scattering length. Or if they're momentum dependent, they'll be powers of the scattering length modulated by functions of A times K. But there are of course scaling violations. There are power law scaling violations from things like the effective range. But these are, and so there are effects that fall off like the range divided by the scattering length. But what Efimov found is that there are also logarithmic scaling violations. There are scaling violations that behave like the logarithm of the scattering length, and And these are things that, unlike these power law violations, cannot be treated as a perturbation. They have to be taken into account. They're essential, have to be taken into account. And they come from singularities in the three-body problem at short distances, from this multiple scattering of successive strong two-body interactions. So let me first remind you the simple and familiar universal aspects of the two-body problem. Again, we're looking at large scattering length and low energies, small compared to the scale set by the range. And the observables are basically the binding energies and the scattering cross sections. As far as the bound states, the universal information is that if the scattering length is negative, there are no shallow bound states. If it is positive, there is a shallow bound state, and its binding energy is given by a simple universal formula. As far as cross sections, the information is richer. The unitarity guarantees that you'll have non-trivial momentum dependence in the cross section, and the cross section will have this universal shape. It'll have some constant value at zero energy, 8 pi a squared. There'll be a region where the cross section is scale invariant, 8 pi over k squared, and then at very high momentum, it can get complicated because the effects of the effective range come in. There's a useful way to present states of the system that at first looks trivial but turns out to be useful. And this is on what I'll call an Efimov plot. It's a plot of an energy variable that's basically the square root of the energy versus an interaction strength that's 1 over A. These have the same dimensions, which is convenient. These hash lines are showing you the scattering threshold. So above here, there's two-body scattering, which I've called atom-atom scattering, just because this is relevant to an atomic physics problem. The diatomic molecule appears only for the two-body bound state appears for positive A, and that lies along this line. And a given physical system, it corresponds to a fixed value of A, and corresponds to a vertical line. So it says that there's a continuum of scattering states up here, one discrete bound state, and that's the spectrum. And increasing the scattering length is moving to the right across this graph. And this is the case, the region of infinitely strong scattering, A equals infinity. And there's a trivial continuous scaling symmetry in this problem, which this figure gives you a simple geometric meaning. It's simply rescaling the scattering length by some factor, rescaling energies by that factor of the minus 2, rescaling observables like the cross section by the appropriate power, in this case lambda squared. And under this rescaling, everything is invariant, which isn't very deep. It's simply the statement that the scattering length is the only important scale in the problem. And so if you scale everything, of course everything is invariant. Okay, well, in the three-body problem, things get more interesting. Again, we want large scattering length and low energies, and the claims that there are universal features. And the most dramatic is these Efimov states, this sequence of three-body bound states that range from binding energies set by the scale of scattering length, and these are large things whose size is set by the scattering length, to very small compact bound states whose size is set by the range, and whose binding energy is set by the scale of the range. And they can be everywhere in between, and the number will depend upon how large the separation in scales is of A and the scattering length in the range. And if I put those on an Efimov plot, they look something like this. This plot is, again, the energy variable, square root of the energy versus 1 over the scattering length. And the hashed lines are the scattering threshold. So above here, we have three atom scattering states. Above this line, we have atom plus plus dimer scattering. And so with three-body bound state, it has to be below this hashed lines. And there is a sequence of these states. And so if you take a given physical system that's in the region of large scattering length, and you increase the scattering, you'll find that a new three-body bouncing will appear, and then another new one, and another new one, until you get to this point where there will be infinitely many. And as you, as A jumps from A equals plus infinity to minus infinity and continues to increase, each of these scattering, these three-body bound states, one by one, disappear from the spectrum.
Where is the accumulation point?
The accumulation point is right here, but I ran out of resolution before I got there. Well, one thing you can see from this figure is that there can no longer be a continuous scaling symmetry, because these discrete bound states are going to break any continuous scaling symmetry. There is something, if you go to the extreme resonant limit, the spectrum of these states is complicated. There's no analytic expression. But if you go to the extreme resonant limit right here, there is something simple you can say, and that is that the ratio of these binding energies, well, first of all, there's infinitely many of them. There's the accumulation point at zero. The ratio of successive ones approaches this value, 515.03. And you can define a scale. The fact that you have these discrete states says that there is a new scale in the problem. You've tuned A to infinity, so A can no longer provide any scale. But you can define a scale by the asymptotic behavior of that spectrum. And I'll call this scale lambda star. And it comes, in this case, with a funny factor of 1.46 because someone else defined it first in a different way. But this is a scaling violation. This is a parameter it's a scaling violation parameter. It tells you even when you make A infinity, there is still some scaling violation coming from in the three-body problem. There's also interesting non-trivial behavior in the scattering observables. For example, the atom-dimer scattering length and also something called the three-body recombination constant. These observables, this one scales linearly with A, but the coefficient is a periodic function of the logarithm of the scattering length, a non-trivial periodic function of the logarithm of the scattering length. The actual form was deduced by Efimov back in 79. The actual the numbers that appear here were only calculated in 99 by Bedok, Hummer, and von Kolk. So you have scaling behavior, except there are logarithmic scaling violations, and more interestingly, the scaling variables, the dimensionless variables, are periodic functions. Are periodic functions of the log of the scattering length. Well, I said there's no continuous scaling symmetry, but there's always obviously a trivial continuous scaling symmetry where you just scale everything in sight. Scale all parameters, scale all kinematic variables, scale all observables, and of course everything will be trivially invariant. But in this case, there's also a non-trivial discrete scaling symmetry. If I take this parameter lambda star, which tells you the Efimov spectrum and resonant limit, and keep it fixed, but I scale scattering length and kinematic variables and observables by appropriate factors of 22.7, everything is invariant. So there's a discrete scaling symmetry, and that's the smoking gun for a renormalization group limit cycle. There's a paper just this year by Ken Wilson and Glazek, which gives you a simple example of a renormalization group limit cycle in a discrete Hamiltonian system. And so if you want a simple example, that would be it. I'm going to describe for you ultraviolet renormalization group limit cycles in non-relativistic quantum field theory. It's states with discrete energies and a Hamiltonian that's a n states, and there's n by n matrix, and you find that
what's the renormalization group?
It's removing the deep states, the highly energetic states from the theory, and looking at the spectrum of what remains. And if can show he sh- Yes. Well, Yes, but as n gets large, things get, and he's looking at the large n limit of a, looking at limit where the size is large. And he can derive an analytic expression for the renormalization group flow, and you can see explicitly the limit cycle in that example. I'll describe two quantum field theories, non-relativistic quantum field theories that have ultraviolet limit cycles, and there are also infrared limit cycles in quantum field theory. One of them is in this problem of identical bosons in this resonant limit, and this is of direct relevance to current experiments in Bose-Einstein condensation. And then there's a problem in QCD where we conjecture that at critical values of the up and down quark mass, there is an infrared renormalization group limit cycle. So let's start with the problem of identical bosons with large scattering length. This is just exactly the problem that was studied by Efimov, but the effective field theory formulation was worked out by Bedok-Hummer and von Kolk in 99. And it's the first little bit, the problem was very, very puzzling at first, and I found it totally baffling, but they figured out how it worked. This is just the simplest non-relativistic quantum field theory you can write down that has simply a two-body contact interaction. Basically a 5^4 field theory. This has divergences. You need to put an ultraviolet cutoff. But renormalization is very simple. If I want this scattering to describe the particle scattering with scattering length A, this is the recipe for the two-body interaction strength. And if you look at that, you'll see it has a ultraviolet fixed point. If I take the dimensionless combination of the cutoff and the interaction strength, it approaches minus 4 pi squared, a constant. This is the exact expression for the renormalization that will give you if you put a momentum cutoff on virtual particles, this is expression, and you take the cutoff large compared to the energy scale, to isolate linear divergences. This is the renormalization that's required to remove all dependence on the cutoff from the two-body sector.
What is the difference between this and four Fermat interaction, which is not Fermat?
These are bosons. So, if these were fermions, I'm sorry? If these were fermions, this would not work because unless you had multiple spin states. But if I have bosons, I can have a... But notice that this is a problem that I have to solve non-perturbatively. If you solve it non-perturbatively, you find it has interesting non-trivial behavior. Solving it just means reducing essentially to summing the series of diagrams, which is pretty trivial. Each loop is just a linear divergence plus some energy-dependent residue underneath it, and it's just a geometric series, so you have the answer analytically. That simple renormalization prescription I gave you makes this exactly equal to this. And here you have an expression for the 2-to-2 scattering involving only the physical parameter, the scattering length, and the energy variable. And this has all information about the two-body system. So if I want to know scattering, I just set this energy equal to the on-shell energy of two scattering particles, which is twice k squared over 2. And I find that the cross-section has this non-trivial shape that I showed you before. If I want to know about bound states, I look for the poles and the energy in this formula. And if I find them, they correspond to bound states. And if the scattering length is positive, there is a bound state. Its energy is highly non-perturbative. It's 1 over a squared. So you have to solve the problem non-perturbatively, but it has exactly the behavior that you should see for the universal behavior. It exhibits in its simplest form the universal behavior of the two-body problem. Well, you can also solve. I'm sorry? Not for non-relativistic field theories. Uh-huh. Yeah, no, that's a great simplification. So the higher n-body sector does not feed down into the few-body sectors. You have conservation of particle number. We can solve the three-body problem as well, although it's more difficult. It has to be done numerically at some level. But you can do it numerically with high accuracy. And you can compute the binding energies of three-body bound states. You can compute the atom dimer scattering length or the three-body recombination rate constant. And the good news is that these are finite. You get nice finite answers. The bad news is that those finite answers depend upon the ultraviolet cutoff. You get a nice finite answer, but that answer will vary as the cutoff varies, and they vary as periodic functions of the logarithm of the cutoff. And, well, what these guys realize is that the source of the problem is really coming from very short distances. This, for example, is what what the atom dimer scattering length looks like as a function of the log of the cutoff. It goes between ranges over all possible values, so there's no limit as the cutoff goes to infinity. But the solution to the problem is simply to add a three-body contact interaction, because the problem is coming from short distances. And what these guys found is that the cutoff dependence of three-body observables can be removed by a relatively simple renormalization. This three-body contact interaction, by dimensional analysis, has to go like 1 over the cutoff to the fourth, but the coefficient is a periodic function of the logarithm of the cutoff. It involves some number S0, which is the solution to a transcendental equation, which is the consistency condition for a solution of an integral. And this, you might have guessed already that this 515.028, et cetera, it looks like exponential over 2 pi, and it almost is. It's exponential of 2 pi over S0, and S0 satisfies this. And if the cutoff has this form for some variable lambda star, it will the cutoff dependence will decrease as you go to infinity. You'll get unique results. So this defines a scaling violation parameter. It's a parameter that is entered through dimensional transmutation, just from the renormalization prescription. But notice that it's a periodic function of the log of the cutoff, and therefore it defines an ultraviolet limit cycle. So this is the simplest example of a quantum field theory that has an ultraviolet limit cycle. This problem also has an infrared limit cycle. Let me show you the Efimov spectrum again. If I have a fixed value of the scattering length,
so this contact term is necessary to normalize three bodies.
Yes.
What about the four bodies?
That's a good problem. That's a good question. Are the universal aspects of the four-body problem completely determined by the two-body and three-body? Or is, in other words, a simple example of a real system is helium atoms, which have very strong interaction. And they form a very shallow two-body bound state. They form two Efimov states. And so the question is that information alone, the two-body binding energy and one three-body binding energy, will that allow you to predict the binding energy of a four helium molecule? And the question is not really solved. Well, there's something very special that gave rise to these logarithmic scaling violations were very, very special, and
they occur in four-body scattering as well.
They occur.
Why should they occur with this three-body they occur for the same reason in four-body scattering.
Yes, so those three-body singularities will enter into the three-body problem, but.
Mm-hmm.
this Efimov effect is does not occur in the four body system in the sense that this the three body problem exists as sub is embedded in the four body problem. So these three body scaling violations will be there. The question is there also four body logarithmic scaling violation, and there's reason to think that there's not. So it.
Can you write down the normalization for each of the two cases? I mean, can we see it just from their own?
For the four-body problem?
Yeah.
No, I can't. I mean, even three-body problem, I can't write down. I can tell you the renormalization, the flow of G3, but I don't have a equation that that's.
Where does that come from?
Where does it come from? From it pops out as the consistency condition for the solution of an integral equation. But I mean, once you know once I have this, how do I?
G3 is not like PR, it's actually blowing up. Is that right? I mean, is that what?
It's blowing. Yeah, it's blowing up and.
So it's not like a Lotus cycle that you drew a little circle, because it's actually.
Well, it depends upon the topology of your space. If I wrap this around in a cylinder, it's just flowing around.
Is there any natural reason to think that G3 would be periodic? And I guess why should G3 be wrapped in that way?
Well, it makes something into a circle. If you want it to be a circle, you can make it into a circle that way. So in this set of coordinates, there's nothing wrong with bad choice of coordinates that give you infinities.
So why is an infinitely attractive potential the same as an infinite repulsive? That's why is it?
It's really that
the physical thing is really periodic.
It's really that if I have my ultraviolet cutoff and I increase it larger and larger,
right.
To keep the low energy physics invariant, I need to tune this interaction strength to be more and more negative. And suddenly I get to this point, and a new bound state pops into the spectrum, and once this new bound state pops into the spectrum, I need to jump it to minus infinity to cancel the effect of the new bound state. And so that's why this is.
G3
is
kind of not the right variable, so probably something else.
You have the formula for how G3 behaves, so if you want it to make it look like a circle, it's a periodic function, so if you want to make the periodic function look like a circle, you can find a way to do that. Okay, well this ultraviolet limit cycle is what you get if you have fixed scattering length, and it's as you take the cutoff deeper and deeper, it's telling you how you have to change the coupling constant. But it also tells you something about the spectrum. As you make the cutoff deeper and deeper, there will be more and more of these three-body bound states popping in the spectrum. So the ultraviolet limit cycle is characterized by a three-body spectrum. It's characterized by fixed scattering length, cutoff going to infinity. A three-body spectrum has a shallowest Efimov state and infinitely many arbitrarily deep Efimov states, the ratio of the binding energy approaching this universal number. But there's also you can also have an infrared limit cycle simply by tuning the scattering length to the resonant point. In this case, there'll be a deepest Efimov state and more increasingly shallow Efimov states that approach, whose ratio approaches 515 in the limit. And this also has an asymptotic discrete scaling symmetry. And if you want to know what is the limit cycle, it's simply taking both of these limits at the same time. Take the scattering length to infinity, to the resonant limit, take the cutoff to infinity, and you'll have infinitely many arbitrarily shallow and infinitely many arbitrarily deep Efimov states, all of which have the ratio of successive binding energies exactly 515.028. Okay, so that's the infrared, I mean, that's the limit cycle in this problem of lone energy bosons with large scattering length. Let me turn now to the few nucleon problem, which you might hope to be able to treat in the same with the same limit as the first approximation, because the scattering lengths of nucleons are known to be quite a bit larger than their effective ranges. In the spin singlet sector, the scattering length is large by a factor of 10. In the spin triplet sector, it's only large by a factor of 3. But in QCD, where it's not unheard of to think of 3 as a large number. Well, this motivates you to try to treat this problem as it approximate the force between nucleons as a zero range potential. Make the potential shallower and shallower and deeper in such a way that you reproduce the correct scattering lengths. But there's a problem, and that is that if you look in the three nucleon sector, you'll find that there is a sensitivity to short distances of exactly the kind discovered by Efimov with bosons. And that tells you that you'll have to, that will bring in a new scaling violation parameter. You'll need some three-body observable to determine that. It'll determine the boundary conditions on three-body wave functions at short distances. So Efimov launched a program to try to describe few nucleon physics in this very minimal way of taking as inputs only the scattering lengths and the triton binding energy and try to predict all other low-energy nuclear physics. And it works surprisingly well. You get roughly the right binding energy from the deuteron. That's not a surprise. It's just the success of the old effective range approximation. But the surprising thing is in the three-body sector, you get almost the right neutron-deuteron scattering length with just from these minimal inputs, knowing nothing else at all about the strong interactions. But there's some limitations to this program. This scattering length is only large by a factor of 3, so this brings in 30% errors unless you start systematically computing the corrections from the effective range, which has been done to next leading order, so it can be done. Another complication is that if you have, there's very few, well, if you have two protons in the problem, you have the complications of the Coulomb interaction, which is non-negligible, and so that makes things a lot more difficult. But anyway, this idea works better than you would expect. Well, the effective field theory formulation of this problem was done by Bedakhammer and von Kolk just a couple of years ago. It's just the same problem in field theory language. So you have an isospin doublet of spinner fields for the proton and neutron. You have two-body contact interactions, a spin triplet and a spin singlet term. But you'll find that that's not enough, that although the predictions are finite, as you take the cutoff larger and larger, they don't blow up. They are not independent of the cutoff. They depend logarithmically, periodically on the logarithm of the cutoff. But you can cure that with a three-body contact interaction of the right spin structure. And the renormalization of that contact interaction requires exactly the same form, same function as in that boson problem. So you have, again, an ultraviolet limit cycle that describes the renormalization of this problem. But, this is not a description that applies to very, you can't take this cutoff very large and believe it. And let me show why you shouldn't believe it if you take the cutoff very large. If you take the cutoff large, you will predict that the three-body spectrum has a triton. And if you'll find that there are deeper guys. There's the next one is 300 times deeper, next one is 500 times deeper, and they asymptotically approach a ratio of 515. But in the real world, you know that the only proton-neutron-neutron bound state is the triton. All these are just artifacts of this model. And so it suggests that this limit cycle is just an artifact of the zero range approximation and shouldn't be taken very seriously. It doesn't have much deeper consequence. And information that supports that is that you can also describe low-energy funucleon problem using an effective field theory with explicit pion fields with chiral symmetry. Again, you have nucleon fields. You have pion fields that might be some SU2 matrix. You have arbitrarily many interactions of pions, but they're all constrained by chiral symmetry. And you also have contact interactions, and that can describe the funucleon problem. And there's no hint of an ultraviolet limit cycle in the renormalization of that problem. So it suggests that that limit cycle is just a artifact. Okay, well, but I claim that it's not. In fact, it's actually a hint that there could be an infrared limit cycle in QCD. And this is based on chiral extrapolations of nuclear forces using effective field theories with pions. This has been done by Bean and Savage and by Eppelbaum, Meisner, and Glöckle. This is extrapolations in the pion mass, which they were wanting to know what would nuclear physics look like if you actually went to the chiral limit. And the answer would look very different. So it's extrapolations in the pion mass, which you can think of roughly as extrapolations in mu plus md, with mu minus md fixed. Again, there's pion interactions and also chiral contact interactions. But these contact interactions are weakly constrained by experiment, and so any extrapolation will have error bars that expand, get larger and larger as you expand away from the physical point. So here's the extrapolation of Meisner-Glöckle of the deuteron binding energy. Here at the physical point, there's no extrapolation uncertainty, but it grows in both directions. And they claim that the binding energy gets close to 10 MeV, gets four times as big if you go to the chiral limit. Bean and Savage have argued that error bars are much larger than that. But what I'm interested in is if you extrapolate in this direction, where the binding energy actually goes to zero before too long, somewhere in the region of 180 MeV. And you can do the same thing for the scattering lengths, the spin triplet scattering length. And when this changes sign, the deuteron becomes unbound. When the spin singlet scattering length changes sign, the dineutron becomes bound. But once you have the information, you can do a chiral an even simpler chiral extrapolation, and that is using this effective field theory with contact interactions, no pions. The inputs we need were the scattering lengths and the triton mass, the triton binding energy. You can get those as a function of m pi from these extrapolations. This binding energy will be the input that we need to determine lambda star. Now, these have been calculated. I just showed you the graph, but this has not been calculated yet. But as a simple approximation, we can just take lambda star to be its physical value. It's something that should not, it's describing scaling violation to short distances. It should not vary dramatically with the pion mass, it should not vary dramatically. If you do that, this is what you see for the binding energies. This is actually the binding momentum. It's the three-body binding moment. I mean, it's the momentum that gives this binding energy. This figure is showing the three-body bound states. This line here is the deuteron-neutron threshold, and it's going to zero when the deuteron becomes unbound. This line here is the dineutron plus proton threshold. When you increase the pion mass enough to make this thing bound, you'll get a scattering threshold. And any bound state has to be above this line. Here's the extrapolation of the triton across here. And what you see is that down here, a new three-body bound state pops into existence. But there can't be any deeper ones because these scattering thresholds prevent you from going any deeper. But these scattering thresholds are, the endpoints of those scattering thresholds are sensitive to the quark masses. And if I could tune these, they're already fortuitously rather close. And if I can tune them to be the same, what I should see is something like this. If I tune them to coincide, you would get a triton, a excited state, another excited state 500 times deeper, another one 500 times deeper, and in fact an infinite sequence of excited states of the triton. And so the conjecture is that the up and down quark mass are adequate to get you to this point where we would see this ultraviolet limits, this infrared limit cycle. So that's the punchline.
So are you predicting that the lattice age people should see those?
Yes.
If they were to look for it, they would.
If, of course, they have to get, these are large bound states, you need large volume lattices, but yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. So just to summarize, our claim is that for the physical values of the up and down quark masses, QCD is fortuitously close to the critical trajectory for an infrared limit cycle in the few nucleon system. And our conjecture is that it can be tuned to the critical trajectory by adjusting the up and down quark masses. This has implications for low energy nuclear physics from lattice QCD, and that is that in practice, lattice simulations are carried out at pi masses that are above 200 MeV, and you're doing a chiral extrapolation to get down to 135 MeV. And that can be dangerous because you're extrapolating past this limit cycle. Things can vary dramatically as of, in that region. And finally, the. Yeah?
What kind of lattice do you think will be specific?
Well, I mean, ultimately.
I was looking, trying to do on a lattice, which I don't think anybody's done, or they're doing it, either on finding that.
No.
I looked at triton binding energy and states the threshold, which I couldn't imagine doing on a lattice or any circumstances.
You can imagine. Would that succeed? Yeah. Okay.
The more interesting question, I suppose, is nuclear matter.
Yes.
If you could ever do that.
And that requires the question, is there universality in the four particle sector as well? Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
yeah,
that's...
You call this a limit cycle. It comes back to Joe's question, where does that normalization come from? And you said, so it, from what I understand, it comes from if I set up the integral the equations for the three-body problem, there are these divergences that arise from this rescattering.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an eigenvalue condition that has to be satisfied.
Yes.
You do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a divergence, and I have to adjust the parameter. Whether that's renormalization or not,
well, go to the three nucleon sector and start integrating out energy shells and integrate out more and more. And if you're at this point, as you integrate out more and more, the spectrum that remains approaches has an asymptotic discrete scaling symmetry. So it really is
But it might be just specific to the three-body problem. Might have to adjust things differently. I mean, you have a total separation of, since particle numbers conserve, each sector can be dealt with separately.
Yes.
They don't interact, so.
Well, the three body feeds into the higher body, but they don't feed back.
The three body did into the three body.
Yes.
So I don't know. It seems to me that nuclear matter is still open because.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The only place it may have an effect on the lattice is as you try to calculate triton binding energies near the continuum.
Mm-hmm.
At this point.
That'd be tough. And this makes it tougher.
Well, you just miss it.
If your lattice is too small, you'd miss in that, yes. But also things would be sensitive to the size of your box. And that.
Well, again, what calculation are you doing?
Well, I'm not doing a lattice calculation, so all I can do is imagine one.
What kind of calculation? What's the energy nuclear physics calculation?
Well, for example, I mean, not only the spectrum, but you would like to know phase shifts as a function of energy and things like that. And these will be very sensitive. Not easily, but well, put things in a finite box and look at the phase shifts in a box and do and see how they change as the box gets bigger and bigger. It's not. I mean, what's that? Yeah, I mean, from the discrete spectrum of the momentum states in the box, you can. I mean, it's not easy, but it's doable. I mean, they are trying to do it in for certain problems in lattice gauge theory. So it's not out of the question. But those will be very sensitive as you, those stations will be very sensitive as you go through this region. That's the problem we understand at this point, is the three-body, is low-energy three-body problem. And the four-body problem is an open question. And my bet would be that the four-body problem also has universal features that requires no new... Mm-hmm. This will not affect the nucleon mass, no. This will not affect the nucleon mass. This is a sector of QCD. It's
No.
The any description that gets the low energy of QCD right will get this right, whether it's full QCD or QCD an effective field theory of pions or an effective field theory contact interactions. The limit cycles in the physics, which is this discrete scaling symmetry. Yes, but the consequences of limit cycle are in the observables, and it's the observables. I mean, it's the observables that tell you that they will be there. What's that? I didn't understand.
All observables, not in the limited class of observables. As you said on slide number one, if you have an ordinary limit cycle, so the couplings are going on, then all observables approach functions that go like this. And here you have a phenomenon that you understand in terms of an effective field theory restricted to a limited class of observables.
Well, low energy, few nucleon system, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's like seeing heavy quark symmetry in the heavy quark sector, and it's not relevant to the pion, but it's that heavy quark symmetry is there and useful.
Well,
if you want to say QCD has no heavy quark symmetry, only the heavy quark sector of QCD has heavy quark symmetry. You're welcome to use that language. The distinction isn't.
It's familiar that we need different realm distributions in different sectors. Okay, in kinematic systems, you've got the Kondor realm distribution when you have an impurity and not when you don't.
Right.
And you have something this. And then you just, you're saying the same thing. I mean, the sector in which this normalization group has.
But therefore, there's no conclusion on the implications of that for other aspects of pieces.
Are you doing that? I mean, is that, wow. Is that, wow.
I mean, aside from calculating three variant bound states, I don't see there are any implications.
I haven't shown you any implications. My bet is that there are implications in the four-body problem, but it's just not been. I mean, it's so much harder than the three-body that.
N-body problem is that easy? I mean, heavy nuclear. Is there any? I mean, is the fact that deuteron is nearly bound have any implications? Nearly unbound.
It may have implications for shallow states of those heavy nuclei. It probably does not have any implications for the ground states of those heavy nuclei. It may or may not. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it seems like it's asking a lot for it too, but it's already a remarkable phenomenon. And
so this has implications for BC, for
in these experiments, what they can do is tune the interaction strength to be arbitrarily large, and then they're exactly studying this problem of the identical bosons with large scattering length. And they should be able to produce FMOF states have nowhere ever been seen. Most promising way, I think, to observe them is to create a condensate of atoms and coherently change them into a condensate of FMOF states. And then you will, for the first time, observe these states that were first predicted 30 years ago.
You create a condensate that's based on two-body interaction.
They've succeeded in creating transferring atoms from condensate of atoms to a condensate of diatomic molecules. And these are triatomic molecules. And so if you understand the transfer process and you understand the FMOF physics, you should be able to figure out how to transfer them to condensates of FMOF states. And then for the first time, observe these states that at this point are just theoretical predictions.
Okay.